Inside the Huddle with Sky Sports, Neil Reynolds and Jeff Rimebo.
Yes, welcome to Inside the Huddle in association with SkySports.com and NFL UK. I'm your host, Neil Reynolds, joined as ever by my partner in crime, Jeff Rimebold, calling in from North America. Jeff, the OTAs are in full swing and there's never a quiet time in the NFL. There's always more news to talk about. And the big news since we last recorded our podcast is Ryan Clady, the Pro Bowl left tackle of the Denver Broncos, torn ACL. He's done for the season. This is that balancing act you talked about, Jeff, the need for getting your off-season working, having that preparation, but protecting players from injury. And it's already a pretty thin area the Denver Broncos have their offensive line. They're protecting a 39-year-old in Peyton Manning. This is bad news all around.
Yeah, it is, because you don't replace that position particularly easily. Left tackles are hard to find, you know, at the best of times, and they're extremely hard to find when you're in OTAs and you're at this point after the draft, primarily after free agency. There's going to have to be a shuffling, I'm sure, in that offensive line in Denver, and somebody who we may not talk about or had anticipated talking about during the season is going to have to step up and play for those Broncos.
They drafted a guy called Ty Sambrello out of Colorado State in the second round, so he's a potential at left tackle. Chris Clark, who played right tackle, was penciled in to be the right tackle. He actually filled in at left tackle for Clady. Don't forget, Clady went down in week two of the Broncos' Super Bowl season in 2013. But, Jeff, already there, we're talking about shuffling around, and there's potential for four new starters on this offensive line. So tell our listeners, you know, just from that whole group, you know, how much communication goes into that group of positions, and is it a problem there if I'm talking about this guy might go here and this guy might go there? I mean, what are the problems there?
Well, you know, we're in training camp right now. We just traded on draft day here, a first round draft choice to Montreal for an offensive lineman that's come in and has become a starter for us.
Right.
And as good a player as he is, it still takes time to put a guy into that group of five. You know, it's interesting. You watch offensive linemen and you watch offensive line coaches, and Neil, you see this all the time when you go visit training camps. You know, the offensive line coach is like a mother duck with her ducklings. They just all kind of follow them around, and it's probably the tightest group, you know, off the field of any of the group position groups. They're typically the same kind of guys. They all are. Just if I could paint with a really wide paintbrush, they're tough guys, they're, you know, down-to-earth guys, but they're all a little bit, I don't know if insecure is the right word, but they just, they all think that the world's against them. And, you know, that they have a, you know, kind of a mentality and a group think that it takes a while to create that chemistry. And then on top of it, so many moving parts, so many things have to be adjusted at the line of scrimmage, protections, who's got who, who the mic is, how you're going to block it, all of the things that the communication and they have to, five guys think as one guy, and that takes time. And now you start moving guys around, and, you know, for example, they say, well, how hard can it be to go from right tackle to left tackle? Well, first of all, your footwork all changes, completely changes. And the style of rusher that you typically see changes. So it is. It's a big chunk that they're going to, you know, that they've bitten off now, and with Clady's injury in Denver, they are going to have to, you know, go to work.
They were talking about that around the Super Bowl when the Broncos played the Seahawks. I remember a great thing they had on American television, Jeff, and it was talking about how Chris Clark had moved over from right tackle to left tackle. And basically, Mark Schlereth was on there, the old Denver Broncos offensive lineman, and he said that there's so many differences because you're doing everything with your opposite hand. He said, so it's basically like the way they did it on this program was they had the guy hit a baseball right-handed, and then they had him take a swing and try and hit the baseball left-handed. He said, that's what it's like swapping sides when you're an offensive lineman. So there's probably a little bit more that goes into it from a technical point of view than us as layman, you know, myself as a layman, just saying, okay, well, you have to be more athletic on the left-hand side, but, you know, and more of a mauler on the right-hand side. I mean, there are technicalities. There's some finesse to this as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I would encourage all the listeners who think it's not hard to just, if you're right-handed, just take a day and say, I'm going to do everything left-handed. And I'm going to write, and I'm going to, you know, eat my breakfast, and I'm going to do all those things. It, you can get it done. It just doesn't feel natural. And so, you know, if you've been a right tackle and that's your natural position and your footwork is all left foot up, right foot back, and your post hands, your inside, your left hand, and, you know, then you go switch over to the other side and now your other foot's up and your sets are all different. And, you know, it does take time. And so, you know, this is not the only challenge that's facing that Broncos offense. They've got a new head coach, new coordinator, new system. And now they have to have a reshuffling of the offensive line. So, you know, the good thing is it happened now. If there is any silver lining in it, it happened now, and it gives them the whole, entire OTAs and the mini camps and all of that to come to a decision about which way they're going to go, if they're going to reshuffle, and, you know, or if they're going to go out and try and find a guy. So, you know, it's life in the NFL. It's life in pro football. It's what we deal with every day, and it's what you sign up for when you get in this business.
And there's the interesting thing, Jeff, because it's, do they go with what they've got and coach them up? And, you know, that's why they have coaches in the NFL, make those players better, make them communicate as a team. Or does this become a fascinating John Elway versus Peyton Manning thing, where Peyton says, go and find me a starting left tackle. This has been the off season of the trade. Go and get me one. Or does John Elway say, well, I'm not mortgaging the future to try and win now, but this is a team in win now mode. So this could play out in a fascinating way. It'll be interesting to see if the Broncos stick with what they've got, which would be the sort of common sense approach to take, because you don't want to maybe give up draft picks for the future. But they may think, we're so close and we've got a quarterback who needs protecting, and he's 39 and his body broke down last year. This could be really fascinating.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about quarterbacks today, and this is one of the factors when you start looking at what you want at the position, and escapability or the ability to extend plays or move in the pocket. Those are all factors in this, because when you have a guy who is, you know, just does not have that ability, and Peyton, as smart as he is and as well as he understands the game and who the free guy is and all of that, you know, he is a liability when it comes to movement. And so now those defensive linemen are going to really tee off. And I think it's going to put a little more onus on the run game, frankly, in Denver. And that's been, you know, that's been a Kubiak trait, though. They've always run the ball extremely well and thrown the ball well off of play action. So I think, again, Kubiak's not a rookie at this as a play caller, as a coordinator, and as a head coach. So, you know, he'll come up with a system and work with Peyton to continue to move the ball, you know, whether it's by throwing it or running it more or play action it more, or, you know, putting a tight end next to that left tackle. There's a number of things that I'm sure they're going to explore as they go forward.
Jeff mentioned we're going to pick our quarterbacks. We talked about doing our top fives. We'll do that later in this podcast. A little bit more news to get through, and we'll take your questions in the mailbag this week. And just finishing up on Ryan Clady, Jeff, there's an interesting, like you said, I think Denver are going to come out running the football a lot more. I think we saw that towards the end of last year. But they have a quarterback who doesn't like to be taken out of games when he's up by 35 points. They have a quarterback who's not used to change. I don't think he likes change. You know, now he's going to be working with a fullback. He's going to be working on a new offensive line. He's a perfectionist. He's at the back end of his career. He is going to have to make some adaptations that maybe he didn't quite bank on when he first went to Denver.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think this is going to be a truly interesting year in Denver, and how much they will, you know, morph into more of a Kubiak-style offense and less of what Peyton is used to, which is in the gun, single back, you know, one tight end, three wide receiver, you know, system. And, you know, again, I think it's going to be an interesting deal. My guess is, however, that Manning realizes that where he is in his career, he's a very intelligent man. He's a very intelligent player. Mm. And I think he realizes that there are some limitations that he has now as a 40-year-old during the season, and he didn't have one, certainly when he was 28, 29 at the peak of his career. And, you know, their offense is going to always run through him, but I think it may appear different to defensive coordinators around the league who are trying to stop him.
Mm. Elway can always, you know, take a trip down into the locker room and say, you know, handing it off in the back end of your career, Peyton, it worked well for me. You got back-to-back Super Bowls. So.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's really the bottom line here. You know, the Broncos recognize, I'm certain, from Elway throughout the organization, they recognize that the window that they have is very, 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 very quickly closing, and that they need to win now. They have to be in win now mode, and it's not just, you know, Peyton, who has some years on that team. It's they've got other veteran players now that are at, you know, probably the downside of their career, but still very, very good players, and you know, they know they have to win now. They've got, everything is about right now, and that's, you know, life in pro football.
Jeff, that is one of the things that strikes me covering the NFL, is those windows of opportunity. They don't close gently, and, you know, they're not slow-moving things. They can shut so quickly that they'll take your fingers off. I mean, we are talking now about the 49ers. We've talked in the previous few weeks about them, you know, being in a tough division and how they may have slid down the order a little bit. I mean, I think we both feel that, yeah, I think Jim Tom Sula, those that write the 49ers off, I think we both know that Jimmy's a heck of a coach and that he's going to make them competitive. But they've gone from a team that were in three consecutive championship games to a team now where some are talking about them being the weakest team in the NFC West. That happened in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, it did. And you know, it doesn't take very much for the competitive balance to change, because, you know, in this salary cap era that we're in, this free agency era that we're in, players move much more than they've ever moved before. Mm. You know, we are in a game that, you know, is a physically taxing game. It's a violent game, and players get hurt, and they're sometimes lost for the season, sometimes career-ending. And then on top of it, you know, you recognize that, you know, it, your game, your life in this game is not, even if you stay healthy, it requires you playing at a peak physical level, and that, you know, doesn't last very long. So there's so much that goes into it. And, you know, it's interesting. I was watching a feature the other day on Bum Phillips and his time in Houston.
Right.
And a lot of people don't realize that they went twice to championship games. They were within one game of the Super Bowl and couldn't get over the hump with the Steelers. And then after those 2 years, it just, the bottom fell out of it. You know, Pastorini was at the end of his career. You know, Campbell was, you know, started his downhill slide. And it doesn't take very much. And all of a sudden now you're fighting to get back there. So when you have a chance, you have to maximize it, and you got to stay healthy. You got to get a few breaks, and you've got to recognize it. But whatever you need to do inside the rules and inside the salary cap, you need to do, while, particularly while you have an elite-level quarterback.
See, Jeff, this is why I enjoy our conversations. We start off talking Ryan Clady and Peyton Manning, and we end up with Dan Pastorini and Earl Campbell. It's like dropping names from yesteryear. I love it.
you know, it's just it's the beauty of this game. This game is so... We have a saying that we use, and it's so true, and I think about it all the time. You know, we stand on the shoulders of those who've come before us. It's actually a Sioux Indian saying. Mm. And, you know, when you're involved in the National Football League and you're involved in pro football, you recognize just all of the phenomenal athletes, coaches, you know, characters that have come before us. It's really a cool thing to be a part of.
Agreed. Totally agree. Ongoing stadium negotiations in San Diego and Oakland as they look towards potential moves to Los Angeles. This one will interest you, Jeff, as we know a member of your family is the official chairman of the Carolina Panthers fan club. Cam Newton signed a $103 million contract extension with the Panthers. $60 million of that is guaranteed. And when we look at the guaranteed money, that's more than Ryan Tannehill recently got. It's more than Colin Kaepernick. It's more than Andy Dalton. But I wrote this yesterday on NFLUK.com. I don't actually have a problem with that, Jeff, because every quarterback and agent that follows the one before is going to try and get a better deal than the man before. And I think they've kind of paid the going rate for a 26-year-old franchise quarterback here.
I agree. And the happiest guy next to Cam Newton and his agent, the next happiest guy in North America is Russell Wilson, because this is now established another... You know, if you will, benchmark for his agent to go into negotiations with the Seahawks and say, how can you, or how can you not pay my guy $100 million or more when a guy who's never been to the Super Bowl gets $100 million? You know, again, that's how the winning window closes extremely quickly. Because even if you can keep that elite level quarterback, it's at those kinds of costs. And the capologists do a great job of manipulating the money and, you know, front loading contracts and doing all that kind of stuff. But eventually that chicken comes home to roost. And if you give that kind of money to your quarterback, other positions are going to suffer. And, you know, you can't have it all. And that's why teams have to make a decision about which direction they're going to go. And typically, Neil, and you know this as well as anybody, they're going to put the lion's share of their salary cap in that position if they feel that guy is an elite level guy.
And because, Jeff, I mean, we're not sitting here. I think both of us have been, we've seen enough from Cam Newton to understand why they've given him this contract, but we're not saying he's the finished product either. He was inaccurate at times during the playoffs. Some of the mechanics, I know, worried you in terms of when he was resetting his feet and trying to throw to another area of the field. But if you're not going to stick with Cam, who you drafted first overall, then you're going to go back into the draft, and there's no guarantee that that works out. And if that doesn't work out, then you're digging around among the likes of Brian Hoyer and Ryan Fitzpatrick. With all due respect to those guys, this is a league of haves and have-nots, and you have to pay him the money. You have to invest in him and then work on those areas of his game, because there's too much talent there.
Yeah, and what you hope is that when you give this guy $60 million, or I'm not just talking about Cam, I'm talking about a guy at that position or a guy that makes that kind of money, that if they don't go into cruise control and say, okay, I've got my money, I've been paid, and now I'm going to play out the string. What you hope is that the guy, it lights a fire into the guy, and that he's going to continue to work to continue to grow and become a better passer, improve his footwork, improve his leadership. You know, all of the things that you would expect out of a guy that you're paying $60 million for. It's a guaranteed $60 million to. So, you know, it's a roll of the dice. And Gettleman and the general manager in Carolina, and all the way up to Mr. Richardson, who owns the team, I'm sure they've had numerous meetings about this and just decided that they had to go all in to keep him, and he's the face of the franchise. And, you know, as you said, Neil, when I was doing my research for the Quarterback Project, you know, it's really, really interesting just how much a league of first level and second level and then what I call the junk pile quarterbacks this league is.
It is a quarterbacks league, and this has turned into a quarterbacks podcast. We talked about Peyton Manning, who's going to protect him. We talked about Cam Newton. And Jeff, I read that Johnny Manziel got into an incident with a fan at a golf competition, allegedly threw a water bottle at him. The Browns have downplayed that and said it was a non-story. So, you know, I know that there was some uncertainty about all of the facts of that story. So, no, it hasn't made perhaps as many headlines as it might have done. But I did read after that with interest that Joe Hayden said that Johnny Manziel is getting harassed a lot by fans for going into rehab, and that the pair of them were walking out of a restaurant, and, you know, there's snidey remarks. And I don't know if that should come with the territory. I don't know if it comes with the territory for every quarterback. You know, I've been around players where there aren't snidey remarks being delivered to them all the time. But I guess we see at that golf competition, yeah, Johnny has to find a way to deal with that better, but then I'm not the one on the receiving end of those jibes all the time. It's a difficult one, this.
Well, you know, I think what the reality of the situation is, when you come into the National Football League the way he came in, and, you know, all of the, you know, the money sign and, you know, Johnny Football and all the hype and all of that, what these guys get set up for is a tremendous fall, and he's fallen. Not just, you know, with the challenge, the issues with his substance abuse. It's the fall, the emotional fall, the psychological fall, the you know, fall from grace, if you will, in the eye of the public. Because the reality of our world is, you know, whether you're in the entertainment industry or the, you know, pro football industry, which is basically a part of the entertainment industry, fans. Absolutely. The number one thing is to create heroes. The number two most enjoyable thing is to watch those heroes fall. And it's a public fall. And Johnny Manziel, if I could have talked to him at a time, he wouldn't have listened anyway, because I'm sure he got counseled this way. Is just come hungry and humble and be thankful for your opportunity, as opposed to come with that sense of entitlement, like you're going to come to the greatest league in the world, and somehow all of a sudden, as a Heisman Trophy winner and all he was as a college player at A&M, you're going to dominate that league. It doesn't work that way very many times, and this game will humble you, and right now he is being humbled.
I think he's been badly advised, and I think he's got bad people around him. And I don't know who's around him, but he got into an argument with a fan in an elevator and an incident at a nightclub. And you just think, if he had the right people around him, then he would be, the minute those sort of situations started to develop, he would be whisked away from those areas without having to get into the argument. Because by the time he gets into the argument, he's kind of got involved and taken it upon himself to sort it out. So whether that's him, no one willing to stand up to him. I mean, if I was advising Johnny Manziel when he first came into the NFL, I would have absolutely said, what are you going to do when you get picked? And if he'd have said, I'm going to walk down the center of the aisle doing the money sign, I'd have been, no, Johnny, just no. And by the way, while we're on the subject, don't call yourself Johnny Football anymore. Just tell everyone that you don't want to have a nickname and you want to be about the game of football. And I don't think anyone ever stood up to him. And I think he's probably surrounded by a bunch of enablers. And I don't actually know who's surrounding him. But otherwise, why would he keep getting into these problems?
Well, I think when this is a far-reaching issue. Mm. You know, you talk about a kid, the way he's been raised. You talk about his, you know, since he first started to play this game, he's been the best player on the field.
Yep.
And that creates a sense of expectation that's unreal in him, in himself, and those around him. And then one of the things you see all the time, and Neil, like I say, you know this as well as anybody because of all the time you spend with the players in the National Football League, that there are always people who are willing to tell you, you know, how good you are and how great you are, and you know, those are, you use the term enablers. That's a great way of saying it, because they want to be a part of the circus. Mm-hmm. They want to be a part of the show. And so to hang around, they will do anything they can, get you anything, do anything for you, tell you anything, just to be a part of the circus. And, you know, those are dangerous people. Those are dangerous people, especially for a young kid who doesn't make particularly good choices. Now, let me just say this, too. I think when you take a player like this, you know, the Brown, there was no question. He had issues at Texas A&M, you know, with coaches and yep. on and on and on. I'm not going to go into all
no,
of it.
No, there was a number of issues.
The reality of it is, when you make him a first-round draft choice like the Browns did, you take that guy, and now you have to manage all of that. I'm not a big Cowboy fan, as you know, but one of the things I will tell you about Jerry Jones and the Cowboys, and they have taken numerous, quote, questionable guys, right? Guys with issues, guys with, you know, entitled, all of it, right? They do a phenomenal job of managing those guys and trying at their best to, number one, educate them, number two, keep the riffraff away from them, and, you know, to the point where they have actually full-time employees who look after these guys, who, you know, try and get them to do the right thing, keep them out of trouble, all that. Now, that's a big load for your franchise to take on. But when you take on one of these players, he comes with all of that other stuff. Mm. And so, you know, it's just a decision that you have to make as a franchise. And the Browns made the decision to take him. And then, in my opinion, didn't put enough around him to ensure that he could, you know, handle that first year, and it was his career in the first year anyway has been a train wreck. And you know, I'm hopeful for the kid that he can, you know, come out, get out of it, but I'm not optimistic that it's going to happen, because I think, you know, there's too long a history there, too much stuff, it's really sad to me.
I think that's a great point, actually, Jeff, because when we talk about Johnny Manziel, all we talk about is what has Johnny done to himself? And I think there's, I think it's absolutely right to shine a light on the Browns and say, if you didn't know what you were drafting, which you should have known what you were drafting, if you knew who you were drafting, then you should have done what you've described and put some support networks around him. If you didn't know who you were drafting, then how the heck didn't you know who you were drafting? Because we see how much work goes into, you know, preparing for a draft. So either way, there has to be some sort of guilt placed at the feet of the Browns.
Yeah, it's never, you know, when there's a messy situation, it's never just one person or person's fault. It's the fault lies in a lot of areas. And, you know, think about this now, Neil. You're doing your pre-draft due diligence on a player, and you recognize that there are issues, and there's, you know, they've spent, I'm sure, hours and hours with him and his agent and his people and his parents and all the, you know, the people that are around him. And, you know, there's no question that you can put stipulations on everything. Okay, now, if we draft you, are you willing to do this, 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 and this? We feel like these things are... And if the kid balks at it before you draft him, well, then you're getting a pretty clear message of what you're getting. Now, again, you have to make the decision. Yeah, you have to make a decision. Is the guy worth the challenge? And do we have the wherewithal? Do we have the tools inside of our organization to put up with and deal with and help that kind of guy? And obviously, it didn't work in Cleveland, or it hasn't worked in Cleveland. And again, I think that the Browns need to share some of that, you know, some of that responsibility. Johnny has to share some. The people around him, everybody has to share some of that.
Absolutely.
Let's move on. Never one person.
Sorry, Jeff. Let's move on to our top five quarterbacks so that we can get through them and then get some of your questions in the mailbag. So last week, Jeff, we talked about our three things that we wanted from our quarterback were accuracy, decision-making, and then I wanted some sort of movement skills. And actually, we had, before we start on our list, we had a I had a tweet from our friend Lee Perry. Of course, not Lee Scratch Perry, but he said, Neil, you want mobility, so I'm guessing you won't have Brady, and Jeff wants, you know, accuracy, so he would have Tom Brady. So you two are about to disagree. I would actually disagree with that, because when I talked about my list of five all having movement skills, I have Tom Brady in that list, Jeff, because I actually think if you watch Tom Brady, yes, he wouldn't win a foot race if you and I were racing him over 40 yards, but he's very, very clever in how he moves in the pocket. I mean, we can talk about Brady a little bit more if you have him in your list, you know, and I certainly do. But I think he's very clever at the way he slides up and avoids pressure in the pocket.
Yeah, I think really that's one of those things when you have to codify, or you have to define what movement is to you. Is it the 40-yard dash speed? Is it the, you know, the Marcus Mariota 4.5 in the 40 kind of escapability, the Colin Kaepernick escapability, Russell Wilson type of escapability, or is it Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady in his prime, Peyton Manning, the ability to move in the pocket, anticipate where the front is going to try and attack, and you know where the pressure is coming from, and how you slide and move just to give yourself that extra second to throw the football. So, to me, the guys that are the out of the pocket guys, the runners with the ball out of the pocket, that's not the kind of mobility that frankly I like. I appreciate their skill, but I think for longevity in the National Football League, you have to be the other kind of guy. You have to have the ability to move and anticipate in the pocket and extend plays with subtle movement as opposed to, you know, just raw speed.
Okay, Jeff, so how should we do? I mean, NFL and football is all about preparation. We haven't actually prepared how we're going to do this. Should we go in reverse order and, you know, I do my number five, you do your number five, or do you want to do the whole list?
Well, I think it's really interesting. This is the way I've done it, and then you can kind of tell me what you like. But I have my five, and then I have what I consider the next bunch, the guys that I think are good enough, you know, that are, I'm not going to call them elite, but I'm going to say they're good enough. And then each of those guys, I did what we used to do in Kansas City when we were looking at players and gave them either a rising arrow, a plateaued, or an arrow that's straight across the page, or a declining arrow. And it's really interesting as I did my work, you know, how how long it takes for a quarterback typically to play at the highest level. And then I also had a group I called, you know, on the rise, and then my limbo guys, and then my junk pile. And,
cool. So you've done a more extensive list than me. I'll tell you what we'll do then, Jeff. I'll give you my top five. Then you give me your, and then we can chew the fat over any sort of startling ones there. Then you can give me your top five, and then we'll take those next players and have a look and see your list. So that we don't dwell too long on my list, we can talk about the ascending and descending players as well. So my top five in reverse order. Number five, I've got Tony Romo. And I think he was outstanding last year. He was just ahead of Big Ben, actually. I was struggling between Roethlisberger and Romo there at number five. Number four, I have Russell Wilson. Number three, Tom Brady. Number two, I have Andrew Luck, actually. And I know people might be surprised that he's ahead of some of those other ones, but I think there's a kind of a reason he's, whenever they do that Pro Bowl draft, he's the first player taken. I think talking to players around the league, there are some very, very good defensive players who've admitted to being scared stiff by what Andrew Luck can do on the field. And I've sort of seen that and heard that firsthand from NFL players. So I think his arrow is still going up. So Luck is my number two. And Aaron Rodgers, for me, is the best quarterback in the NFL. So mine goes number one, Aaron Rodgers. Number two, Andrew Luck. Three, Tom Brady. Four, Russell Wilson. Five, Tony Romo. My next group would include Peyton Manning, who I'm... Again, I worry about the movement skills and what I saw at the end of last season. Drew Brees, I thought, forced a few too many things last year, and there were turnovers that crept into his game. I really like Big Ben Roethlisberger, and I actually think Ryan Tannehill's going to ascend and get up into that group this year. So that's mine. What about your top five and what sounds like a much more comprehensive list you've got going there?
Well, you know, when I looked at this, the first place I went, Neil, was to the quarterback ratings, you know, right. And as you look at the top 10 players in quarterback rating, and that is that sophisticated mathematical breakdown that they use, statistical analysis, analytics, to use the term that's so, you know, hot right now, of the top 10 guys. And you know, if you look at it just on quarterback rating, it goes Romo, Rodgers, Roethlisberger, Peyton Manning, Brady, Breeze, Luck, Palmer, Fitzpatrick, and Wilson. Now, shockingly to me, as I looked at that list, only two of those players are in their 20s. The rest of the list is all 30 years old or older, which is really phenomenal. And you've got Romo, I'm talking about during the season. They may not be 30. They will turn this age during the season.
Yep.
Romo, 36. Roethlisberger, 33. Manning, 40, Brady, 38, Breeze, 36, Palmer, 35. So it does give credence to that thing that it takes time and that the elite are the elite. They have been elite, some of them, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you develop one, or are they just born? That's the other thing. Now, I went over and then I looked at, because to me, decision-making and accuracy are the two most critical things, and those are reflected to me more in touchdown interception ratio.
Yep.
And you look at those guys, and I'm going to tell you now why I chose my guys in this order. Number five to me was, and I think on the rise, and there are reasons why he's still at five to me though, Tony Romo.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went Big Ben at four.
Yep.
I went Andrew Luck at three, Tom Brady at two, and then Aaron Rodgers at number one.
So our difference is Russell Wilson and Ben Roethlisberger. The reason I had Wilson in there was I think when he is asked to, and I think he's still an ascending player, I guess he's held back by the offense. I'd be interested to sort of get your take on Russell Wilson because to me, when he's asked to make the throws, he can put it in there with tremendous accuracy. He's just not asked to throw as much. So there was two things I wanted to ask you. Russell Wilson, and then both of us, and maybe it will surprise some people, both of us have gone without Peyton Manning.
Well, I think the Russell Wilson thing to me was, as you look at him, right, you got 20 touchdowns and seven interceptions.
Yep.
That's not a great touchdown interception ratio. There, I thought he protected the ball better, frankly, his first year starting than his second year starting.
Yep.
The issues that I have, why I would take Roethlisberger or Wilson, is just Ben's ability. You know, they both, they're interesting in that they can get away from the rush in two separate ways.
Yeah.
Wilson, you know, with his athleticism, and Roethlisberger, just because he's like having an offensive guard back there. He just throws guys off of him to keep plays alive. But, I you know, Roethlisberger has that big arm that I like, the ability to throw, to drop back, you know, five or seven steps and throw that wide field out, the ability to, you know, throw the home run ball down the field, which we saw last year a number of times. And I think he's really matured at the position in terms of his decision making. Now, a lot of this is, you know, sometimes the statistics are reflective of the offenses that they're in. Because, as you say, Russell Wilson, you know, is not in a throw first offense. He's in a run first play action offense. But to me, I want a quarterback who can make the throws from the pocket to beat you. Because eventually the defensive coordinators in the National Football League are going to make you do that. They're going to make you throw, particularly when you get to second and long and third down, they're going to make you throw from the pocket and they're going to make you make those throws. I haven't seen the body of work yet from Russell Wilson for him to be in my top five.
Yep.
And that's not a criticism of the kid, because I love the kid and I love his everything about him. But just at this point in his career, I can't say with my hand on my heart that he's in my top five, because I don't have that body of work yet.
Okay, Jeff, this is where this is going to get interesting then, because it'd be interesting to see your next group, and maybe if you could put them into the ones that have still got the arrow pointing up and the ones that have got arrow pointing down. I didn't do this or prepare for this, but just jotting down, I actually think, well, there's some big names who I would put an arrow down on. I would say Peyton Manning, arrow going down. Drew Brees, I would say arrow going down. I would probably say that about Eli Manning. I still think Matthew Stafford could be an arrow going up kind of guy for me. I think he maybe played a little bit too within himself last year, but he had some injuries at wide receiver. And as I've said, I already think Tannehill is an arrow pointing up guy. Be really interesting to get your take on that next group of players and which ones are on the slide and which ones are on the rise.
Well, I put Eli in my limbo category, and I'll tell you why when we get to that group of players.
Okay.
But, you know, when I looked at that next bunch, I thought Matty Ryan is still an arrow up guy. I think Stafford, I agree with you, arrow up guy. Russell Wilson, an arrow up guy. Phillip Rivers, to me, arrow down guy. I love Phillip Rivers. But again, I gave him arrow down because I think real soon we're going to start to see all of those hits and all of those injuries for all of those years start to take their toll on him, you know, as he gets to the twilight of his career. Carson Palmer, again, I like him, but he's, to me, at this age and with the injury history that he has, he's an arrow down guy. Andy Dalton, I gave a plateaued arrow to. Drew Brees, arrow down. Peyton Manning, arrow down. Alex Smith, I gave him a plateaued grade because, again, I don't know if the issue with throwing touchdown passes to the wide receivers wasn't really more a function of, you know, the offense that he's in. You know, I think the interesting thing when you look at this next group of guys, I think they're all capable of winning for you. I think Cam Newton's an arrow up guy, but each of them has something about them that makes you go, yeah, you're just not there yet. Ryan Tannehill, don't have the body of work.
Yep. Got
to make sure that you stay away from the interceptions. You know, Joe Flacco, I think Joe Flacco's on the cusp of that, but again, Joe Flacco's dealing with a separate issue. He's now in his third offensive coordinator in 3 years at the time when he should be at the peak of his career. So
Jeff,
it'll be interesting to see where he goes now this year.
Let me just stop you there with Joe Flacco, because I'm sure there were Ravens fans kicking their phones all across the street, because we between us named about 20 NFL quarterbacks there before we got to Flacco, who, interestingly, I don't think he made the top 100 that's on the NFL Network at the moment. And John Harbaugh came out and said, I'm glad I've got a superstar quarterback. Ravens fans would argue, have you not seen my guy in the playoffs? I mean, we are talking excellence in the postseason. So why doesn't Joe Flacco? Because I haven't got him anywhere near the top of mine either at this stage. But, you know, I don't know quite why that is, but he performs in the playoffs, Jeff. I mean, it's outstanding stuff in the postseason.
Well, I think, you know what? We just talked about some of why, because Joe Flacco's personality is not that,
right.
Not that flamboyant guy. There's nothing about him that you go, wow, other than the fact he wins in the playoffs. And that's why I gave him an arrow up. I think he's on that next very close list of guys. He's good enough to win a Super Bowl for you. And that's give us a chance to make the plays in the playoffs from the pocket that you need to make to win the Super Bowl. And he's proven that he can do that. Just like Russell Wilson's proven that he can win a Super Bowl. That doesn't make him, to me, an elite quarterback. That does make him a guy who's in that list of guys, and I didn't rank them. I just put them all together of guys that I think if I was a general manager in the National Football League, I would feel pretty good about the position. Andy Dalton, I would feel pretty good about the position. What I would say if I was in Cincinnati is we have to find either the players around him to help him get us over the hump, or we have to unlock whatever it is in him that's preventing him from playing well at playoff time. And their football team, he's not the only one that doesn't play well at playoff time for the Bengals.
We're going to get to the in limbo and in trouble guys. I mean, we've not heard Colin Kaepernick's name yet. We've not heard Sam Bradford.
Yeah.
Who are those guys?
Yeah. Let's talk about the kind of limbo guys, the guys that are hard for me to really put a tag on. You know, McCown's the first one. Because you saw enough in that one season in Chicago when Cutler got hurt that you'd say, you know, it's there. And then all of a sudden he goes to Tampa and he looked like the guy that, you know, had been a journeyman backup his whole career. So I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens to him in Cleveland. Hoyer, I don't know what to do with him. I think he's one of those guys that's not quite good enough, probably going to always be a backup. Sam Bradford. Because of the injuries, one of the most accurate guys I've ever seen in college football and has just suffered with behind bad offensive lines and a run first mentality in St. Louis. No receivers in St. Louis. So it'll be interesting to see how he works with Chip because I think there's talent there. I just don't know if he's so beat up now that he can rebound from it. RG3 is another one. The flashes, man. There's all kinds of flashes on tape of his greatness. Have the injuries taken their toll? Has the off the field stuff, you know, all the stuff that always swirls around him become a distraction? Cutler, he to me he's an enigma. You see all the great physical tools and all the things he can do, make all the throws, and you know, but there's just something there that makes you go,
those are the frustrating ones, Jeff, aren't they? Those guys are the frustrating ones. Because those ones that have talent.
Those are the guys we call coach killers. Mm. You know, they're the ones that will, you know, you just see it and you just think that, gosh, I can just get this guy to play and make the decision, look at his physical skills, but somehow he just implodes, you know, I guess. Kaepernick, I put in that list because I think it's going to be really interesting. This will tell us an awful lot about Colin Kaepernick. Now that Joe Roman's out of there and he's going to be in a different system, we'll see, you know, how much of that success was manufactured in that offense and how much, with his new system, you know, the true quarterback, you know, how much he's grown as a true quarterback. Remember, this kid came out of Nevada as an athlete playing the position.
Yeah.
And is, you know, developed. And I think he's still in that developmental stage. And to me, one of the marks of a great one is when they can switch systems and switch coordinators and switch head coaches and their play continues to go on the rise. And I think Nick Foles is one that I can't put a handle on because I saw that great year in Philadelphia than I saw last year. Mm. And so let's see what he does in a new system.
It's hard,
isn't
it?
Those are my limbo guys.
Yeah, you need a body.
Yeah, those are.
You need a body of
those,
work.
Those are my. Yeah, those are my limbo guys. And then I thought the on the rise guys to me are Carr, Bridgewater, and Bortles. I think each of those young kids has shown, you know, that they have the physical ability to play in the league. You know, Bortles. You always worry about a guy like Bortles who's playing behind an offensive line early in his career where he just, you know, he's getting hit all the time. That does take a toll on guys. Mm. But I think Bortles was a good draft pick. I think Bridgewater's shown he has, you know, skills to win games in the National Football League in David Carr. So that's my on the rise guys. Now my junk pile guys. I'm gonna throw some names at you now.
Shopping it's in my Poundland. Junk pile. Go on.
Geno Smith.
Yeah.
DJ Manuel. Now that's cruel because those guys are young in their career. But boy, you talk about issues.
Yeah.
Now. Accuracy problems, decision making problems, all of it. Christian Ponder, Brandon Wheaton, Tim Tebow, and Blaine Gabbert. Now, it's what's the common thread that runs through every single one of those guys?
Decision.
They're
all high draft picks.
Decision.
But they're all high draft picks, and I think they make bad decisions. And then there's various levels of pocket awareness that is missing. But yeah, you actually. Great point, Jeff. They were all first-round draft picks, and that goes back to that debate we said about, you know, if you give up on Cam Newton and you dip into the draft, there are no guarantees there. That's, you know, it's kind of a hit-and-miss thing in the draft, even with first-rounders.
Yeah, even, I mean, it may be bigger with first-rounders in terms of it's just a crapshoot, because you look at the, you know, when you start looking at the other list, you've got, as you go through it, I mean, shoots. Aaron Rodgers slid when he was drafted. Tom Brady was a late round draft choice. Obviously, Andrew Luck was a first rounder. You know, Peyton was a first rounder. Romo, come on now. I mean, so you got two guys on my top five. One's a free agent, and one's a late round draft choice out of top five. And I look over on my scrap heap, and I've got whatever it is, seven first round draft choices.
Yeah.
So anybody that thinks they got a crystal ball is kidding themselves. And so, you know, when we talk about first round picks, and that's what makes it so incredibly interesting, and it's going to be so much fun to watch Mariota and Winston because they were the ones this year that everybody said, you know, had those quite quote can't miss grades. Well, everybody can miss, you know, and it just goes to show you because right now that junk pile's stacked with a smoking, steaming heap of junk.
Jeff, you know that junk doesn't steam. Something else steams. I know where you're going. I know what you're trying to say. So listen, this is my top five then, just wrapping this up. Aaron Rodgers at one, Andrew Luck at two, Tom Brady at three, Russell Wilson at four, and Tony Romo at five. Jeff's top five is Aaron Rodgers at one, Tom Brady at two, Andrew Luck at three, Ben Roethlisberger at four, and also Tony Romo at number five. Next week, should we tackle running backs, Jeff? Not literally, obviously.
Let's do that. Let's find the five toughest to tackle.
Yeah. So that's quarterbacks. We'll move on to running backs next week. Let's take a few questions in the mailbag, and we'll start with this one from Willie Trencher, who says, is the stance of the Detroit Lions in placing a premium on a player's character going to become the norm in tomorrow's NFL? It shows how quick things change in the NFL, Jeff. We're talking about the Lions being a team that upholds player character. A few years back under Jim Schwartz, they were deemed the bad boys of the NFL, but maybe this is a reflection of Jim Caldwell as a head coach?
I think it's some of that, and I think it's a sign of the times. You go back and you look at the things that have gone on in the last 4 or 5 years, 6 years, if you want, in the National Football League with player behavior off the field, the issues, the players. I mean, I think it's getting to the point now where organizations are frankly saying, "Hey, we'll hold on a second now," and. I think that's good. I think that's actually a very good thing. I think that, we have to remember that it is an honor and a privilege to play in the National Football League. It's not a right. It's not, you have to earn that right on the field, and you have to maintain that right with what you do off of the field.
This is a good question, Jeff, from Liam Holmes. He says, in general, how many coaches are there on an average NFL franchise? He said, I've been listening to talk about the OTAs this week, and there seem to be loads. Jeff, you can weigh in on the detail of this, but I think it's important that our listeners understand with each NFL team, there is no salary cap, when it comes to coaches. That is the one area where there are no financial restrictions on a franchise. They can have as many coaches as they wish. I mean, how does it normally break down?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. When we were at the Super Bowl, if you remember, we you know, before in the lead up into the show, we were doing our work, and you start to research the staffs, and interesting enough, I have friends on both of the coaching staffs, and the Seahawks rolled into Phoenix with over 20 assistant coaches. Mm. And on the other side of the equation, here come the Patriots, and I think it was 12 or 14. I can't remember exactly the number, but significantly different number of coaches on the coaching staff. It's just a philosophical thing where, you know, some guys like having a bunch of guys around. Other guys think when you have too many, you know, when you got too many, you know, too many Chiefs and not enough Indians, that the message gets, you know, diluted. Mm-hmm. So again, it just comes down to what a team wants to have. Pete loves having a bunch of guys around. He manages people extremely well, and you know, they seem to have a single mindset amongst those 20 guys. Now you go to the Patriots, and they're done a completely other way. There's one voice that you hear, and that's, you know, Belichick's, and that's the way he wants to run his organization. So typically you're looking at anywhere between 14 to 20 is the typical number of coaches on a coaching staff.
I think one of the things I've noticed, Jeff, in the years covering the NFL, when I first sort of started out covering the league, there was a defensive line coach, there was a linebackers coach, there was a defensive backs coach, and more and more you're seeing, and maybe that alludes to what you're talking about there with Pete Carroll, there's an assistant defensive line coach, then there's an assistant linebackers coach, there's a special teams coordinator, and then there's a special teams assistant. There's more teams now doubling up at each of those positions, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, it's interesting. There's more specialized coaching going on now than there's ever been. You know, you look at defensive staffs, and it's not unusual to have a defensive coordinator and then a guy who is responsible for coordinating the run defense, a guy that's responsible for coordinating the nickel defense, a guy that, you know, so the danger of that is that, you know, when you start getting multiple people have an input, obviously you got multiple egos involved. And frankly, you know, as much as you and I agree on most things, Neil, it's still different. When you say blue and I say blue, you could mean, you know, the navy blue, and I could mean, you know, Honolulu blue with the Lions jerseys. I mean, they're both blue, but they're different. And so how the message gets to players is the most critical thing. And it's interesting, I've heard numerous players tell me that sometimes they get mixed messages when there's too many voices speaking in the room. And that's one of the challenges in coaching of managing a coaching staff is to keep the message consistent that the player gets. Because when a player gets inconsistent messaging, he can't function at a high level.
That's interesting, Jeff, then, because you talked about, you know, the message and being on the same page. Maybe one of those coaching positions that didn't seem to last that long was the sort of the clock management specialist. Remember Dick Curl, the old Frankfurt Galaxy head coach? He had that position in Kansas City, but did it not last because, you know, that's got to be the head coach who's making those kinds of clock management decisions at end of game?
I think what they've done is they've kind of, you know, amalgamated that into another guy's responsibility.
Right.
Where it's really interesting, you may have what they call quality control coaches. And what a quality control coach's job is to do all of the analytics, all of the breakdown, all of the, quote, paperwork, if you will. It's all computer work now. All the film breakdown to prepare the coaches, the game plan coaches. These guys have very little. Some never even step on the field. But they're in, you know, little rooms around the National Football League, and, you know, with their face stuck in a computer and cutting up film and making training tapes. And, you know, it's amazing. If the fans really understood, when you come in, this is not unusual. You come in off the practice field. Like today you've got two practices this morning, you know, today in training camp. We'll come in off the practice field from the first camp. In 45 minutes on our desk will be all of the tape of that morning's practice cut into individual plays we can go into the computer and we'll say, okay, give us all the passes this morning. Give us all the second and long plays. Give us all whatever it is we want, all the pass rush, one individual player's plays, whatever it is. Those things are all coded into the computer, and then they're instantly accessed to us. So we can go into the meeting that afternoon, and if, let's say with my linebackers, I want to talk about, you know, all of our, you know, two deep coverages, how hard drops in two deep. Boom, into the computer it goes. Within seconds, it's up on the screen, and we can access those individual plays. Or, you know, my punter wants to see all of his punts off the left hash where he was trying to put the ball into the boundary. That can be brought to him, and within seconds, he's in it. You know, he's able to, you know, evaluate himself in those situations. So the technology that these guys have now is phenomenal, and it's really amazing.
Those kind of requests in the past would have had a quality control coach drowning under bits of broken off tape in the film room, wouldn't they, Jeff, back in the day?
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, you couldn't get that kind of information. No. You had to wade through tape, and it makes the coaching of the athletes so much more efficient. But there is a point now, and I think sometimes we get to this point, where you just saturate the athlete with information. He just can't handle any more information. And, you know, there's a thing called paralysis of analysis, where they've gotten so much, they've gotten so many numbers, so many statistics, so much film, that frankly it slows them down because, you know, they just can't process it all.
One more question from the mailbag as we wrap up this week on Inside the Huddle. It comes from Gavin Buck. Now, Jeff, put your coach's hat on. I'm going to give you a choice here, and I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, I want both. Well, you can't have both. I'm the general manager. We don't have...
You're starting to sound like you're starting to sound like a general manager, Neil.
We don't have enough cap dollars. So what is most important... This comes from Gavin Buck. He says, what is most important in a good defense? A good pass rush... or a good secondary? Where would you invest that money?
Well, you know, this is a really great question, because
I've made myself cough. I got so excited being the general manager.
Well, let me just say this: one of the guys that I hold in very high esteem, and it's sad because late in his career it kind of fell apart on him. But Al Davis was one of the really geniuses of our game. Mm. And one of the things that he always believed was that you build defenses from the corner in.
Yep.
First thing you do is you go find yourself some guys who can play man-to-man, and then you build from there. I subscribe to that theory because I think there are enough ways, if you can cover, that you can stop the run by having too many guys in the box for them to block, and you can rush the passer by just blitzing with one more than they can protect with. But to do both of those things, you have to have great corner play. You have to have guys who can, you know, just lock people down. And I think Seattle's proof positive of that. They've led the league in scoring defense the last 3 years, and what defines the Seahawks defense more than anything else? The Legion of Boom. Now, if you have great pass rushers and you don't have guys outside who can cover, I don't care how good they are, because you can always double team or add more protection. If they can't hold up outside, it's going to be a long afternoon.
All right,
and I think the Jets are proof of that.
Yes,
last year they have great pass rushers. They just didn't have anybody to cover anybody.
Nobody to cover at the back end. Jeff, we're out of time. Listen, next week we will do our top five running backs then, and we'll take more questions in the mailbag. And I'll be recording from the US, Jeff. I'm going to be visiting the Miami Dolphins, the New York Jets, and the Jacksonville Jaguars. There's a good chance that we'll record this on Tuesday, and I'll be in my hotel on the beach in Fort Lauderdale. So if I'm on the beach this time, could you please go in a storeroom just to make it 1-1?
Not a chance.
Not a chance. All right. But we will. I think also, Jeff, when we do our running backs, we should pick who we think are the five best, not necessarily in terms of getting the most carries, because there are more running backs that run by committee now, aren't there? So let's try and look at, if we can, look at who we think are the most talented guys.
Yeah, we'll take the five that if you were the general manager and gave us carte blanche, who would we go get? Okay, I got you.
I like it. I like this, this whole general manager thing.
You were just the general manager, and you told me I couldn't go have both. I want both. That's what coaches always want. They want everything.
I know. Listen, I'm the general manager. I give the orders around here. Until next week, say goodbye, Coach.
Aloha.